Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show.
Quiet, please. Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You all ready?
Exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. All of this could have been avoided if we'd followed my plan.
Broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
What was it you were saying about my voice?
It's loud, it's strong, and it's good, and I appreciate your support.
This is Honestly Provocative Talk with Lars Larson.
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.
Now, here's Lars Larson.
Be sure and keep that volume up.
On FM News 101.
It's going to be one of the highest rated shows ever.
KXL.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Monday on the Radio Northwest. Now, we're glad to be with you throughout the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, serving the Pacific Northwest with Honestly Provocative Talk Radio. We'll be glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And boy, do we have a lot to talk about today. I wanted to start with this. I want you to imagine this picture. Most cities in the United States of America are proud of their biggest corporate names. That is, I'll bet Chicago is even proud that while Nike's world headquarters is in the Pacific Northwest, that its corporate headquarters is located in Chicago. You know that there are cities like New York and Philadelphia. You know that Miami and Houston. You know that cities all over the country are proud of their biggest corporate sponsors. And they work as hard as they can to try to get more of those big companies to locate, because those marquee companies mean a lot to a city. It means that when you have a marquee company like Boeing or Microsoft or Amazon or Intel or Nike or any of the rest, that you can sell that to other people who are thinking of moving to your town and say, you know, we're the headquarters of Precision Castparts, for example, the folks who make almost all the, you know, the blades and all the jet airplanes that you fly around the world. They're made right at PCC, right? Precision Castparts Corporation. So what happens when one of those companies, Columbia Sportswear in this case, built to the size that it was by the hard work of Gert Boyle and her son Tim Boyle? And by the way, I reached out to Tim today and asked him if he would come on the show, and I got a reply back from his staff that said, no, we're going to pass on the opportunity at this time. But he wrote an opinion piece in which he has said that one of Columbia's big brands, a brand that all of us who buy outdoor boots know the brand, whether you own them or not, you know Sorel. And it's a big brand. And I'll say, I've got a dog in the fight. I've got a pair of Sorels. I've probably got a couple of pairs of Sorels, but I know I have at least one pair of Sorels, just like I have a pair of Danners that I bought with my own money, because when it gets to be cold in the Northwest and it gets to be wet, you need the proper kind of foot gear. So when Sorel has its corporate headquarters in the middle of your town, and to great fanfare 1 year ago, they announced that we're going to locate our corporate headquarters. We're going to put 45 of our most important people right in the middle of a Pacific Northwest city. In this case, it's Portland. And then a year later, the head of the company that owns that brand, Tim Boyle from Columbia Sportswear, writes an opinion piece in which he says, the downtown of Portland is too dangerous for our employees to come to every day. It's not because of earthquakes. It's not because of tsunamis. It's not because of hurricanes. It is because the city has allowed, and the decisions by a lot of liberal politicians, and to some extent, I have to admit, I think Tim Boyle is reaping a bit of what he sowed, because Tim is a relatively liberal guy. And he supports liberal causes, and he supports liberal politicians. And some of those liberal politicians are the ones who've made the decisions that have ruined Northwest cities, because they have policing policies and homeless policies and how much you can sell drugs on the streets policies that have led to such a dangerous situation. Let me read, since I don't have the access to Tim Boyle. Like I said, we invited him to come on today. He politely declined, and that's fine. Tim Boyle was visibly thrilled last November to announce Columbia Sportswear was moving 45 employees to new downtown Portland offices. 1 year later, the company is considering closing the Portland office after its downtown staffers reported a series of frightening run-ins with transients and car break-ins so frequent that they have come to refer to them as Columbia's laptop donation program. Employees reported clashes and aggressive panhandlers and repeated car break-ins. One worker said her life was threatened. And as Boyle wrote, it is a relief when the only thing we deal with on a given day is garbage and human waste by our front door. Those are the good days, when you literally find a pile of crap by your front door and garbage, and when your employees are not being threatened. Now, my question that we're putting on the Twitter poll, have the big cities of the Northwest become too dangerous to tolerate? And are they that way because of the politicians who make the decisions about how those cities are policed and the policies that they run under? We're going to get to that and a lot of other subjects, but I want to get you into this conversation as well. Even if you're a naysayer, you go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
I'd have to say that if the tidal wave of sexual misdeeds in Hollywood creeps you out, and it certainly creeps me out, wait until you see what Oregon's senior senator defends. Democrat Ron Wyden actually ranks as a bit of a faker anyway, since he represents Oregon, but he actually lives in the state of New York. Back in the day, Wyden made his bones in politics defending the very vulnerable, in that case, older Americans. So it surprised nobody when Wyden wrote a bill to create a law to go after sex trafficking of human beings, many of them children. The bill has 46 Senate co-sponsors from both political parties, and so it is almost certain to pass. So now why has Wyden decided to oppose his own bill? He actually doesn't want them to vote on it, even though he's got the votes to pass it. If approved, the bill allows lawsuits against internet companies that advertise sexual services, like the company known as Backpage. Now, you'd only know Backpage if you read the back pages of some of the alternate weekly newspapers, and you'd be disgusted by what you saw, because it's very much about pedophilia and pornography and hooking up people with sex traffickers. So Wyden now says his own law would hurt the internet companies and innovators and startups. Does this really have more to do with the big donations that Wyden gets from the tech sector? The Washington Free Beacon reports that the Oregon senator counts Google as his sixth biggest single campaign contributor. Now, the senator wouldn't put money for his campaign ahead of protecting children from internet perverts, would he? Now, today's grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Arm Yourself Gun Store in Hillsboro. Proudly veteran-owned and open 7 days a week. ArmYourselfStore.com.
Today's Daily Grill is actually suggested by the reporting of the Eugene Cash Register Guard out of Lane County, the People's Republic of Lane County. The new head of the Oregon Health Authority, Pat Allen, he acknowledges that they've already found $74 million worth of bad payments made by the state to Medicaid providers. Do you know what he told lawmakers last week? He said he expects more Medicaid payment problems in the future. And remember, these are the ones where $74 million got paid inappropriately, in other words, illegally, to people. And clueless Katie Brown, the governor of the state, says, I had no idea what was going on. She is doing her best Sergeant Schultz routine right now. $74 million paid to the wrong people. You could have surprised me. I mean, I had no idea what was going on. Oh, and by the way, vote for me for another 4 years so I can be governor again. Clueless Katie Brown, if you vote for her, you deserve what you get. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com, comes from Denny Caves. Lars, am I to understand that Portlanders are fine with cutting down trees for their holiday festivities, Christmas trees, but they're not fine with cutting down trees to create jobs and income? Kate Brown, of course, needed that big Portland Christmas tree. Of course she did. She had to have that. And by the way, it's a holiday tree, not a Christmas tree, at least here in politically correct Pacific Northwest. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. All the issues of the day right here for the Pacific Northwest, reported on by the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And Steve writes in, Lars, even worse for Tim Boyle. He's talking about the head of Columbia Sportswear. He's the CEO of the company. His mom, Gerd Boyle, is the one who took over after her husband's untimely death. And all the sharks started circling. And Gerd Boyle, while her politics are not my politics, I've known her for a long time. I don't see her very often. And I know that she's very different from me politically, because when we have conversations, we can usually tell, you know, that I support different candidates than she does. That's fine. She's brilliant as a businesswoman. When all the sharks started circling after her husband died, said, hey, honey, we can take that company off your hands for a few. We'll put a few dollars in your pocket. And that's the way she described it to me, that she felt these people, these guys were just going to take it from her, hand her a couple of bucks, and that was going to be that. And she gave a response using words I couldn't use on the radio. And I admire her for that kind of toughness. And she built a $4 or $5 billion a year, biggest sports outerwear retailer in the world company out of something that a few guys thought they could take off her hands for a few bucks. But Tim, he says, Steve says, Tim, even worse for Tim Boyle, when you do a map search for Sorrel, they show up in Science Parkway in Cedar Mill. Tim may have employees in downtown Portland, but he's using a Beaverton address. Maybe to avoid Portland and Multnomah County taxes, I don't know. That may be the case, but I'd love to have talked to Tim and said, who do you blame for this mess? And I've talked to my friend Kirby Wilbur up at KVI, our station in Seattle, and said, do you think there are some companies in Seattle that have moved out of town? He said, oh, yeah, and he named a couple of them. So the biggest cities of the Northwest, the ones that you would think would, and they work overtime to attract new companies. Sometimes they make it a public appeal. Oh, please, Amazon, come to our town. We'll give you all these goodies if you'll come to our town. What good does it do to be the city that has to tie up, you know, like the kid, you have to tie the pork chop around his neck to get the dog to play with him? You've tied the pork chop around his neck, and then the dog has been invited in, and then the dog takes a bite out of the kid. That's what's happening. You move to a town because the town talked you into coming there because you're cool. You're so cool and you're so hip and you've got microbrew and you've got voodoo donuts and you're just a little off kilter and you're proud of Make Portland Weird until the weirdness comes to your front door and leaves a pile next to the front door of your corporate headquarters. And you say, maybe this Keep Portland Weird or Keep Seattle Odd or whatever it is, or Eugene, maybe this isn't all it's cracked up to be. Let's go to, I'll tell you what, let me go to Tuck Willow first and talk to Greg. Greg, how are you doing? What's on your mind today?
You're familiar with Wajamaya's because you have it like in Beaverton, I think. The head of Wajamaya's last year wrote an open letter. I think it was in the Asian Weekly. It was one of the free Asian papers. To Mayor Murray and the council, tell him how bad it was in the international district. Some guy coming in, spreading sheeshies, all the stuff that was happening on the street, and asking them to do something. And I got to tell you, Wajamaya's put one in Renton just down the street, and I was so glad it was like 2010, something like that. I was so glad because of like one less reason that I have to go to Seattle, because I really try not to get past the SoNo area and all that. But, I mean, it's not the only person writing a letter in a city having these kind of problems. I just thought you might want to know that.
No, I appreciate that. Because, Greg, look, I know this can turn into just let's bash the big cities, all right? And I don't want it to be that way because the biggest cities are big for a reason. They are concentrations of capitalist activity, right? And I think sometimes the big cities give short shrift to those people outside the cities who actually make things and do things and grow things and create things. And the big cities act as, I mean, New York's the worst at it. They act like the rest of the country doesn't matter. Like everything west of the Hudson River is just New Jersey, a big old New Jersey out there. But the problem is, once you have that giant concentration of capitalist activity, you should be able to use it for something. The problem is when you put the people in charge that you put in charge, like Ed Murray, who was, you know, obviously flawed himself because of his sexual proclivities and his weirdness, that when you expect people like that to be concerned about, well, what about the conditions in the city? They act as though, well, if we buy the nicest furniture, and in the case of the city, furniture is light rail trains and space needles and bridges that look like architectural statements to the world. And you say, if we buy the nice furniture, everybody will think we're a great place to be. And no, not if you allow people to treat the place like a toilet. And the last time Tina and I were in Seattle, we were stunned. It's the same kind of homeless encampment spilling out everywhere that you see in Portland and you see in Eugene. And when those people then turn around and say, we'd like hundreds of millions of dollars to build a fancy mall or to really beautify downtown, you say, why would we buy you all this fancy furniture when you allow, you know, basically people to come in and destroy all of that?
Can I give a historical perspective?
Sure,
another
please,
city?
Please do.
Many years ago, I grew up in Cleveland, left there when I was 14, but they had an area called the Flats, which was all abandoned industrial when the Rust Belt melted. But like in the 90s or whatever it was, they built that, put in all kinds of clubs. People were coming down there. It was great. And then the conditions started to deteriorate, crime, all kinds of things that, you know, that don't incur. And people just kept away, and literally it melted. I mean, it just literally went away. Now they're rebuilding it, and they're paying more attention to, like, making sure that a certain element and all that doesn't come in. But literally, they had a gold mine, and they urinated it all away, more or less, by just not, you know, doing what you're supposed to do. You know, getting the criminals and all those folks from preying on the folks that wanted to come there. That's a perfect example of, and Cleveland has spent decades shooting itself in the foot. It seems to be turning itself around
as
now.
As has Detroit, as have most of the big cities in the country. And now we're watching it happen here in the Northwest, which used to have a reputation that, yeah, we're a little oddball, a little bit offbeat. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a great place. Yeah, till you find out that even companies that are hip and cool say, we can't stand this stuff going on, and we're going to move out. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. But first, I want to take a great opportunity to talk to a great friend of the program, and that's Kim Strassel from the Wall Street Journal, from their editorial board. Kim, you've once again written a bang-up column that has, you know, said something that none of the other journalists in America seem to be saying about the Steele dossier, the one that was used to try to defame candidate Donald Trump before he became President Donald Trump. Welcome back to the program, and tell me why you describe this as one of the dirtiest tricks in American political history.
Well, first of all, hi, Lars. It's so great to be here, and thank you.
Sure.
So I think people have focused so much on the Trump-Russia collusion story and the dossier and whether or not it has any accuracy or not. And by the way, nothing really in it has ever been accurate other than the broad allegation that Russia was involved with cyber hacking in the campaign, something they've done for a long time. But the reason I think this is a dirty trick, and you can go through the timeline, is that the Clinton campaign, in essence, paid for an opposition research firm to then hire a British spy to put together this dossier. That British spy then sent it to the FBI and then ended up briefing reporters who in turn said, oh, intelligence officials have received information that Donald Trump members of his campaign are colluding with Russians. So it was a virtuous circle for the Clinton campaign in that no one ever had to prove anything. The press was able to write about this, made it sound as though it was coming from the intelligence community itself, and never mentioned that this was dirty opposition research.
Well, and one of the things you pointed out is that there's been a kind of a fiction maintained by some of the major news organizations in America, CNN among them, which has continued to say to people, by the way, none of this was ever publicly reported until X, until after the election. But the fact is, you detail in your column how all these reporters from the biggest organizations like the New York Times and others were all briefed back in September. So they got this information because of Steele putting this stuff together, even though, as you point out, most of it, other than the broad outlines, there's no truth to any of the allegations about Donald Trump.
Right, and that's the important point, is that Christopher Steele was hired basically as an opposition researcher. He puts together a document that really has been discredited, no validity, but would nonetheless make some wild allegations. Then he goes and he briefs the American press about this in September. And we can actually show, and it's in the column, that there really had been no talk at all in the American political cycle about this supposed collusion thing until suddenly this guy goes and briefs these reporters, and you have this story. And we know that he did this, by the way, too. He's testified to having done so in court documents. And among these briefings were one to a Yahoo News reporter named Michael Isikoff. And not long after that briefing, he suddenly comes out with a piece, and the headline is, U.S. intel officials probe ties between Trump advisor and Kremlin. And at the time, this was a bombshell story. It guaranteed that for the next month, what we talked about was possible Trump-Russia collusion. And yet it was all based on this document that the Clinton campaign paid for.
And by the way, not only did they pay for it, but they commissioned it. I mean, every campaign does some opposition research. I mean, even if you're running for a local city council position, you're going to say, well, let me look up my opponent. And if you find out he's got a Dewey, driving under the influence, or if you find out that he had a business go bankrupt, these are things you may mention. And there's nothing illegitimate about them. But in this case, Clinton's campaign and the DNC, correct me if I'm wrong, spent $12 million that they paid through a Seattle law firm as a cutout so they could keep all this work private, and that some of it was commissioned with a company called Fusion GPS that itself has ties to the Russian government, correct?
Correct. And this is one of the things that still really needs to be investigated, because one of the other things that we found out this week is that the head of Fusion GPS happened to have been holding meetings with this infamous Russian lawyer, the one who set up a meeting with Donald Trump Jr. And he was in her company the day before and the day of and the day after she was meeting with Donald Trump Jr. So what he has said, he didn't know about that meeting, but this is all highly suspicious. I mean,
Hold on. I want people to think about this for a second, Kim. He meets with this Veselnitskaya, I think is the way you say her name. He meets with her the day before her meeting with Donald Trump Jr., the day of and the day after. And somehow the subject of her meeting with the son of the Republican nominee to be president of the United States never comes up and never gets mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I think it strains credulity. I mean, and that gets to a bigger question then, too, because if he was aware of that meeting with her, but put it the other way, was she aware of the work that Fusion was doing to put together this dossier? And if she was, did she communicate that information back to the Kremlin? Because one other beautiful aspect of this story, Lars, is that when this first came out, the story of how she had met with Donald Trump Jr., the press went all out because, of course, they were all in on the collusion story. They wanted to prove that this woman was an agent of the Kremlin. So they actually did some decent reporting showing how closely tied she was to Putin. But now it's sort of turned on its head. So if in fact she was aware of what the Democrats were doing and she let the Kremlin know this, was the Kremlin in turn manipulating what was in that dossier?
Well, and were they, tell me if I'm wrong in asking this, is the reason that she met with Donald Trump. She used a predicate for meeting with him that turned out to be not true. Allegedly, she said, I've got some dirt on Hillary. And then when she meets with him, it's actually about the Magnitsky Act, which is a separate, it's another issue that involves the Russian government, that if the reason for her meeting with Donald Trump Jr. was maybe the government of Vladimir Putin trying to compromise the son of the man who might become the next president of the United States. So in other words, yes, the Russians are screwing with us, but they're screwing with both sides, and they don't care who gets elected as long as they have a way to influence the people who get elected. Is that the way to say it?
Right. And that is highly possible. We do not know what her connections are back to the Kremlin precisely, or whether or not she was sent out to do this. But she certainly does have links there. And that, by the way, you're bringing up the Magnitsky Act is another important thing that gets to the question of Fusion's honesty in saying that they didn't know about this meeting. Because the one thing we do know is this was the work that Fusion was doing with Mrs. Veselnitskaya. They were working on lobbying against the Magnitsky Act. So the idea that supposedly she was going to meet Donald Trump Jr. and talk to him about the Magnitsky Act, this thing that they worked with Fusion on, and Fusion didn't know about that meeting, again, that's difficult to understand.
Well, so where does all this go? And do you think that at some point CNN and some of these other major media can be shamed into being honest about this and stop this line that, well, none of this got reported publicly, and admit that there were reporters who were briefed in on this, that it helped to make up this, you know, nonsense that we got pushed right before the campaign, that there were ties between Donald Trump and Russia, and that it was mostly an invention of the Democrat Party and Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, well, the short answer is no. I think the media is beyond being shamed. they have kind of gone all in on one side of this story and are committed to seeing it through to the end, even though there is still a lack of any evidence to that point. The question, I think the immediate follow-on question here is what we need to know is the House needs to continue demanding to see the FBI's documents, because all of this stuff about dirty campaign tricks, that's fine, but it isn't necessarily illegal. The bigger question would be, did this dossier in any way inspire the FBI's probe into the Trump campaign and lead to things like wiretapping of campaign officials and public citizens? That would be incredibly concerning, and we should get some answers to that.
One, and maybe was it used as some of the predicate to go out and stage a SWAT raid in the middle of the night on Paul Manafort's home?
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, well, exactly, because, look, whether or not, I mean, if the FBI ended up using this, right, initially to do the Trump collusion investigation, that obviously has led to a special counsel, which obviously has now led to indictments. So, yes, there were real-world consequences of that dossier if it did indeed inspire it initially.
Kim, it was a great column, and I very much appreciate you taking the time today to talk about it.
Thanks, Lars.
You bet. Kim Strassel, a member of the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, will be back in just a moment with your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let me grab some of your calls as well. Danette is on the line in Vancouver. Hey, Danette, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Well,
Lars, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. What's on your mind?
And you can help us get the word out. Something pretty exciting has happened here. Evergreen High School in Vancouver, their Wind Symphony Band has been invited to perform at the prestigious 2018 Bands of America's National Festival in Indianapolis in March. And we have a fundraiser going on right now.
Sounds fantastic. How much money do you have to raise to make all this happen?
Well, to make it all happen, it would be over $60,000.
Wow.
But
I know.
There's 47 band members. Our goal is to raise $25,000, but I do see on our site that it's been changed to $10,000. So I'm hoping we can still shoot for the $25,000.
All right. So how can folks who are listening help you out with this?
They can go out to WeFundForYou. That's the number 4.com/fundraiser/Evergreen Band.
Yeah.
And they can make a donation there.
That sounds.
And then they can also share the word too with Twitter and Facebook and any way we can get the word out. And there are only 8 days left for this fundraiser. It ends on the 20th of November.
You know, it's interesting that I know I'm going to get calls from people saying, well, or emails from people saying, but is it tax deductible? I don't know. Do you happen to know? Is it a donation to a 501c3 or something like that? Because I know for some people it makes a difference.
You know, I can't answer that question, Lars. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer.
Okay. Well, at least it's for a good cause, right?
It is, and all the funds go to help the entire band so that we can help lift some of that financial burden on the families, because we just found out about this invitation in September, and so we have a very short window of opportunity to get these awesome kids to be able to have this incredible experience.
And, Danette, what's the address again for people to look?
wefundforyou.com/fundraiser/evergreenband.
Sounds pretty easy. And if somebody didn't catch that, we're glad to, we're glad to make it possible. You just email me and I'll get you the information. No problem whatsoever. Let's go to Gary in Estacada. Hey, Gary, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Yeah, Glenn, this would be Lars.
What's that?
I'm a homeless. I got a different slant. I'm 81 years old and I've noticed my entire life that I've lived here. The taxes keep getting out of sight, and I think a lot of those people, I'm not speaking a lot of them, but some of them have been taxed out of their homes.
Who's been taxed out of their homes?
Well, people that have earned not very much money in their lifetime, and they can't keep up with the tax base.
Well, hold on a second. If you're making money and you're being taxed, you still, look, everybody who makes money gets taxed. People who make very small amounts of money in America get taxed either zero or less than zero, believe it or not. So if you're down at the poverty level...
I'm talking about property tax, home taxes.
Well, but if you have a property... If you're paying property taxes, I understand that in some places, property taxes will run up to $23, $24, $25 per thousand. So if you have $1,000 of value, you have to pay $23 in property taxes per year. If somebody is being taxed out, I mean, the natural thing to do would be to say, the taxes are too high here. I'm going to sell my property here. So if you had, say you had a $200,000 house in Portland, which would not be a very expensive house in Portland, you'd be paying about $4,000 a year in property taxes. If you sell your $200,000 house, if you've got, say, $100,000 in equity or $50,000 in equity, you're going to walk away with some money. So is that what you're talking about, where somebody is forced to sell their house because they say the taxes
say
are too high?
No, you never plan on selling your home and you want to die there.
Yeah.
You can't afford to hang on when you're in retirement like I did.
Hold on a second. Does Oregon not allow, I thought they still allowed a property tax deferral when you get older. So that, say you're
the... You got to qualify, Lars. You got to qualify.
Qualify how? By income?
When you turn in before the Board of Commissioners that you would like a deferral.
Yeah.
There's only so many a year, the way they tell it to me down there.
That's not the way I've heard it. My understanding is you can get a deferral if you're above 65, if you're retired, if you're on Social Security, et cetera. You get a deferral, and then when you finally pass... Whatever is owed on that in property taxes has to be paid by whoever inherits it. So let's say somebody has a house that's $150,000 or $200,000 house, and they defer $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 worth of property taxes till they pass away, which would be...
Well, Lars, I've been through this with those commissioners, and you have no rights. And they only pick, let's just pick a figure, 6,000, 10,000, 20,000 people for deferral. If you're number 20,001, you don't get qualified.
My understanding is it's not a set number. It's if you hit the criteria, then you get a deferral because the county knows they'll get the money eventually. When you pass away, your heirs who inherit the house will have to pay off the amount of taxes that's due. And so,
well, anyway, that was my slant. My next question or my next comment,
real quick, because we're up to the break.
Okay, it's very important that they vote in a person like Trump that knows how to create business.
Yeah,
because Obama has proved it's a way to die here in this country with no money coming in.
That's a possibility. And think about this. Anybody like Trump in the Northwest right now running anything? You got the Lars Larson Show.
Something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now.
Lars. Real Red Meat Radio.
Radio
should be played at high volume.
This is the Lars Larson Show, broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
When enough people make false promises, words stop meaning anything.
This is Honestly Provocative Talk with Lars Larson.
Your voice is beautiful. I've heard it for a long time.
You are enjoying the miracle of radio.
Now, here's Lars Larson.
Bunch of swipe left on Lars Larson. Some dignity back in the White House.
On FM News 101.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment, but it's a real pleasure to welcome back to the program Bob Zybak, who is the president of Northwest Maps Company and a man that we usually talk to when it comes to sensible ideas for how to manage Northwest forests, which, you know, the governments of the Pacific Northwest don't seem to have a sensible idea for how to manage forests. Bob, how are you?
I'm excellent.
So where do we stand now with the whole mess that is the State Department of Lands, in this case in Oregon, and the way that they're working with or not working with the State Department of Forestry about managing some of these forests out there for the benefit of all the kids in school?
Well, the Elliott Forest is set aside specifically for school kids. It was put together over a several-year period, and it is a school trust land. So it's managed specifically for the school children of Oregon. And 2 or 3 months ago, Department of Forestry stopped managing it. It went into private management hands because they thought they were going to sell it at about 25 cents on the dollar. But yep. There's a lot of response to that, negative response. And I think part of that might have been discussion on your radio show that helped in that regard.
I would hope that that's what happened, because we tried to make it clear to people. I want to see the biggest bang for the buck for Oregon school kids. And the idea that they're still managing this thing at a loss. You know, I mean, only government could take a valuable asset and run it in such a way as to lose money on a valuable asset.
Well, there's 20 states with school trust lands, and the Elliott Forest is the only one to lose money, and it's probably the most valuable on the books. The concern is on July 3rd, the state decided to, the people in charge of the Elliott, which is the state land board, which was set up in 1859, governor, state treasurer, and secretary of the state, decided not to sell it, but instead to purchase a $100 million bond that I guess the school kids will have to pay back instead of being trustees, instead of holding the land in trust and managing it. So there's nothing going on there now. You may recall that we proposed an alternative management solution, which would have given 35,000 acres to spotted owls and marble murrelets.
Right.
That seems to be the main political hang-up, but also create over 400 jobs and produce over $400 million for the schools and still stay in state ownership. So that's been well received locally in the Coos Bay area, and that they need jobs. The schools need money, but they've just shut it down. And now the concern is that the $100 million bond, which will be used to study spotted owls and marbled murrelets, will be used to tie up the entire forest, and it will never come into production again.
So that means it'll just, what, keep growing trees until Mother Nature comes along and burns it all down, or it dies of bugs and disease, or what?
I don't think they understand forestry that well. That's the whole problem. I mean, the Columbus Day storm blew down 100 million feet there. The 1868 fire burnt up the entire amount beginning in the 1850s and through World War I. Much of the land was logged. Splash dams were put in. Fish runs were stopped. And now it's being heralded as ancient forest and old growth. And it's been a working forest for well over 100 years, and specifically an obligation of the state of Oregon to manage forest school kids since 1930.
So what do we need to do next to try and get some kind of different treatment of these lands?
I'm not sure. What it sounds like on a legal level is that the state's pretty much tied it up, but I think that an informed citizenry, and especially those associated with funding schools or with local jobs in rural areas, would take some action on this and do just what we're doing, put the light of day on it.
Well, and that's all I want to do is make sure that we get some good out of this, because every time I drive through these forests in the Northwest, whether it's federal forests or state forests, I just think about what a big financial tragedy it is that we can't take full advantage of these trees, cut them down, send them off to the mill, replant them, have brand new forests. I mean, Bob, when I drove twice to Pendleton in the last month and a half or so to go elk hunting and deer hunting, and both times when I drove past the forest there in the Pacific, in the Columbia River Gorge, where there had been the big fires, and you have to slow down to about 10 miles an hour because they've had to make some modifications to the highway while they're doing some restoration work on the side of the road where those forests burn, you can see how packed with timber, or packed with small trees. It's not really timber at this point, but it's small trees, how packed they are. And you can see how easily a fire could just rip through those areas. And you think, wouldn't a sensible person go in and thin that? Do some pre-commercial thinning so that, you know, some of the best trees can get taller and bigger, and the junk trees could be removed. But they're not doing any of that.
Well, and then they blame a kid playing with firecrackers for starting the fire. But it's really the people that have let these fuels build up, because the Columbia Gorge and the Elliott State Forest are both locations in which forest fires have had a regular history. Wind throw has been a problem. Ice storms occasionally, there's landslides. All of these things affect the dynamics of the forest. So in the Elliott, which is right close to the Pacific, some of these actions have been really severe, some of these events. And so what we have is a second and third growth forest, and it's being paraded publicly as an old growth forest, as ancient forest, as valuable, and I'm putting quotes around it, marble muralette habitat. And the reality is, there's been people living there for thousands of years. There's been sawmills there for over 100 years. And there's less than 1% of the land in old growth. And yet the birds like it. So apparently there's not a correlation, or a strong correlation, between old growth and marbled murrelets.
Yeah, although don't try to tell that to the Birkenstock crowd, because they think that murrelets and spotted owls and the rest only live in old growth forests, and therefore, and not in Kmart signs and some of the other places that they've been found. Bob, do you want to refer people to the website where they can find more information if they really want to read up on this? Because it's a huge issue, and it literally involves hundreds of millions of dollars that either could go to the schools or won't be going to the schools, depending on the bad decisions made in Salem.
And hundreds of rural jobs, excellent rural jobs. It's www.orww.org, Oregon Websites and Watersheds Project, Inc. And the Elliott Forest button is right there. And it's got the radio interviews with you, articles written about it, legal background, and so on. So people that want to get a better education regarding forest dynamics and Elliott Forest and our school trust lands can go there.
We'll be glad to send people there. Bob, thank you very much. Bob Zybak, the president of Northwest Maps Company. Coming up in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, if you've been thinking that in all these sexual scandals involving Hollywood and Wall Street, that somehow the Northwest has been left out, perish the thought there. Rick Jacobs, who's the news director at the NBC affiliate at KGW Television, is on the phone with me right now. What kind of sex story are you doing tonight on the news, Rick?
Well, Lars, we're just about to break this on KGW.com and at the news at 4, 5, and 6. Interesting case against the most well-known golf course in probably the whole Northwest, Bandon Dunes. A woman who was one of the top executives there, Darla Hamblin, is suing for $500,000. She's claiming that the GM, Hank Hickox, sexually harassed her for years, from 2001 to 2016, would make sexual comments, grab her, and she was afraid to complain because they're owned by Kemper out of Chicago, and they had a reputation of the executives there kind of the good old boys club. So she never really complained because he was a GM. She complained to him, told him to knock it off. Kemper, she never complained to Kemper. Kemper says as soon as she did, they took it seriously. It all goes to court tomorrow in Coos County Court. court. It's going to be a very interesting case if it goes. I'm really curious
about this, Rick, because every time I hear about one of these, one of the first things I want to ask, I think women should be taken seriously when they level these kinds of charges. But I always wonder, she never complained for all these years. Was she let go at some point, and did that have something to do with starting this complaint?
No, she's stuck around the whole time. So, okay, you know, so she claims she,
it's a different
she
situation.
Complain. She didn't feel comfortable complaining. So, you know, we have all these documents. I haven't poured through them like my reporter, Pat Doris, has. But it's an interesting case, given the light of what's happening around the country.
Oh, my goodness. It's like every day I walk in and there's some new charge against somebody either in politics or in entertainment or in movies or something like that. And you kind of wonder where all this is going to go, in addition to all the things that are being said about this Senate race in Alabama and Roy Moore.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, what makes this also interesting is Bandon Dunes. You know, it's a very, very famous. It's famous around the world.
Well, isn't it? I'm not a golfer, but I admire these golf courses because they're beautiful and they're maintained with private dollars. But isn't it ranked as one of the top five public golf courses where the public can go in the world?
I think so, Lars. I think there are two of the public courses that are ranked in the top 10, I know, in the country. I'm not sure about the around the world, but I know that I'm not much of a golfer either, but all my friends that play it say it's spectacular, and it's world-renowned. So, you know, this case we just found out through a tip and got all these documents, and it goes to court tomorrow. The trial begins tomorrow. It's supposed to last 4 or 5 days.
Sounds like it's going to be interesting. Now, are you surprised that we've only had one sexual harassment complaint out of the Oregon legislature? This is the one.
Well, one and maybe two, right? And I think we're going to hear more. I think there's some folks have a reputation. We're hearing kind of behind the scenes that more are going to come out. So I guess we'll wait and see on that, huh?
Absolutely. So tonight at 4, 5, and 6?
Absolutely. We're going to break it online momentarily, Lars, on KGW.com.
Well, and by the way, what kind of feedback are you getting? I have to give a plug to my little bit that I do with Steve Novick, the left hook, right jab. That we've been doing for a while. Are you still getting good feedback on that?
Yeah, I told you, Lars, we hear really people like the debate. They like the discourse. They like you two going at it. And what are we going to talk about this week? Is it homelessness?
No, I think what we're going to talk. In fact, we always go through a debate because I like a more pointed question. I want the question to be, and I think this is the one we've arrived at, that downtown Portland has become so dangerous for average folks who work there that one of the biggest companies in America, Columbia Sportswear, that owns Sorel, has warned the city, we're probably going to pull the corporate headquarters of Sorel Boots out of downtown Portland because they feel that their employees, 45 of them, are too much at physical risk of attack by simply being in downtown Portland. And Rick, I got to tell you, when you see all these cities all over the Northwest, you know, Spokane and Seattle and Eugene and Portland and Medford and Bend, they're all trying to make themselves look friendly to companies to say, come to our town. We're a great town to establish a headquarters in. What does it say when somebody like Tim Boyle, the head of Columbia Sportswear, literally one of the biggest sports outerwear companies in the world, you know, multi-billion-dollar company, says it isn't even safe to have people in an office in downtown Portland? I think that's a terrific indictment of a city.
And yeah, I'm not sure it's just Portland. I meant that on the homeless front because I think a lot of crimes are committed by the homeless.
Oh, but did you notice that in the story about it, they never mention the H word? You see that? They don't mention homeless. They mention transients. In other words, when you're talking about homeless, you use the H word. But when you're talking about people being attacked or, you know, having human waste left in front of their office, it's always some other word than the H word. They use the T word or they use the some other word. And that's always struck me as interesting that they make that kind of distinction when they're talking about a negative thing.
We're doing more on that story today as well, Laura.
Are you?
That's a big story. You know, the CEO of Columbia saying he may pull out of downtown. I mean, you know, that's got to get the attention it has of city government and the business alliance. I mean, everybody is talking about this.
Well, right? I invited Tim Boyle to come on, and he didn't. And his politics are a little different than mine, so I guess that's just it's you know, par for the course. But what I wonder about is, what is the proper response from City Hall? Because unless they do a real 180 with the cops and say, we're going to go out and crack down on the Antifa protests and the homeless and the encampments and all the other garbage that goes with it, I don't think they're going to be able to change fast enough to make a change that'll actually change the situation.
So I think Wheeler's in the hot seat, and I think he's hearing it right now, and it's going to be interesting to see how he responds. I think we all feel like he did respond to the protests downtown and taking the streets. I mean, when he took office, there was some pretty swift action to get those folks off the street and the couple of protests that followed under his watch.
And I admire him for that, and I've said so, because he's a whole different approach than Charlie Hales was a year ago. But what we're not seeing is a big change in the homeless picture, because, again, City Hall has this warm and fuzzy attitude that, well, we have to spend more money on them, and we can't tell them they're not allowed to camp here. Well, that, you know, that kind of presence of people who are drug addicted, drug affected, drunks, addicts, criminals, you know, there's a lot of bad stuff that comes with this homeless crowd. Some of the people are benign, and they are, in fact, victims of the people around them. But the people around them that sell drugs or buy drugs or use drugs or are drunk or, you know, and choose that kind of lifestyle or choose to be antisocial to the point where they're physically dangerous, where they attack people, tolerating that kind of stuff is just bad. And I don't see City Hall changing that.
Well, it's going to be interesting. I mean, with Columbia coming out and saying they may pull out, I mean, it's the front burner right now. So it'll be interesting to see how they react to this.
Rick, I appreciate you coming on. Thanks so very much.
Thanks, Lars.
You bet. That's Rick Jacobs, who's the news director at KGW. Like a big story on sexual harassment involving Bandon Dunes. And he's right. Even for a non-golfer like me, I know that that is one of the top golf courses in America. And it is a real gem on the South Oregon coast. We've actually had the man who's the money behind Bandon Dunes on before, because I think he pays something like 2/3 of the property taxes in Coos County as a result of this, because it's, you know, it's such a big operation compared to everything else that's there. And of course, timber has been given the bum's rush out of there, so they're not much of a force anymore. But recreation, boy, it says something when you drive past the little airport down there near Bandon Dunes in Coos Bay in Bandon, and you see a row of private jets of people who've flown in from all over America to golf at a place here in the Pacific Northwest. That's a real asset to have. And if there's a lawsuit involving one of the top operators at that course, that's pretty serious. To your calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our quick poll or Twitter poll today goes this way. Have the big cities of the Pacific Northwest become too dangerous to tolerate? Columbia Sportswear, the latest example of a complaint to that effect. It's brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and your emails. You know, every once in a while, I get an email from somebody and they make a persuasive case that they are in a very tough situation, not of their own making, and that they deserve maybe a little bit of extra attention to it to try to correct what's going on. Well, I got just such an email from Cassandra Sassy, and I tell people, Cassandra, you know that I always tell people if I have a dog in the fight. So I don't know you and your family. I don't know you and your husband, but you sound like you're a great family. You got 7 kids. You've got one child who's had to have some extra, you know, help because the child has special needs. But then your family suffered a real setback when the primary breadwinner, Dad Lyle, was out doing his job, working for Triad Machinery. And he was up on a road delivering some machinery or picking up some machinery, and something went wrong. Welcome to the program, and would you mind telling my listeners what happened?
Yes. November 1st, Scott was working. He often works up off of the grid up with the loggers, and he works on heavy equipment up there. And they were headed down one of the logging roads. I'm not exactly sure of the numbered logging road up the Kalama River Road. Mm-hmm. And they were in a tiny convoy of a group of workers. And the road started to give way, and it pulled his truck. It started to pull it off the cliff, and it kind of pulled it into a ford where the front end was hung on some trees. And the trees snapped, and he went down forward, the front end of the truck first, and flipped over about 150 feet down into the Kalama River.
Now, this is a big work truck. Like, it looked to me like a 5 or a 10 ton work truck. I mean, it wasn't a deuce. Was it a deuce and a half, or was it something bigger? Do you know?
I'm not exactly sure. It is a very big truck. for holding all of his tools. It's larger than the average.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just a big pickup truck. This is a huge work truck that has a lot of tools on it. And your husband went end over end in this truck, 150 feet down a slope?
Yes.
He ended up busted up pretty good, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Do you think you can talk about that? I don't want you to get upset or anything, but it sounds like he suffered a lot of breaks and a lot of damage.
He did. I'm very, very happy that he's alive. He does have some severe injuries that have to be monitored right now with the spleen, and he had some quite a few broken bones, the ribs and lower back, and the facial bones and jaw. And he had somehow got his left leg hung up and mangled where it's swollen to twice the size as the other, and it's got like seromas, they called it, which is going to take a little bit to go down. It's pocket filled a fluid of damaged tissue is what it is.
Yeah, because his one leg is twice as the size of the other leg from the damage that he suffered. Now, still in all, your husband says he plans to be back at work in January?
Well, what the trauma doctors told us is that on the broken bone areas, that's 12 to 14 weeks out. They haven't told us, like, if he can go back to work at that time. That's what we were looking as far as recovery for those. I know on the spleen, 6 weeks, they have to rescan it to make sure there's no fluid around it, because he was in the ICU, and it was very iffy if they were going to have to remove his spleen at that point.
Ouch. Well, let me ask you this, though. What surprised me, and we'll give the GoFundMe, because you're trying to raise some money, because obviously if Dad is the breadwinner for a family of seven, and he's going to be out for at least a few months, even though he's got insurance, he's got a great company behind him, Triad Machinery, sounds like they're doing everything they can to help. And I guess it doesn't surprise me, Cassandra, to hear that, gee whiz, our government-run workers' comp system is not necessarily as good as it's cracked up to be, because your husband's being treated by his own doctor for some of these terrible injuries he suffered, and then your doctor says, oh, by the way, I don't take the kind of insurance that workers' comp is offering. Is that right?
Actually, I contacted his physician because I was directed to do so by the trauma surgeons, that he needs to have follow-up care and be monitored.
Right.
And when I contacted them, they wouldn't even let us come in when they found out it was a workman's comp case, because they don't want to deal with the paperwork or the issues of workman's comp.
So in other words, here's a doctor who's saying, look, I could fix your husband, but the nonsense that goes with all the paperwork of workers' comp is just too involved. We would prefer not to do it.
That's exactly right.
Even though I would guess that that surgeons like that probably do insurance work all the time, but for private insurance companies, not for government-run insurance companies. Because if I were in a car wreck tonight, God forbid, I assume there's a surgeon who put my legs or my arms back together, and they would call Farmers up, and Farmers would pay the bill. But in the case of Safe, maybe not so good. So you went to the State Accident Insurance Fund, correct me if I'm wrong, and you said, hey, can you give us a list of doctors who could work on my husband who do take workers' comp? And they did, right?
Right. She actually told me that all doctors, I can go to any doctor I want to. And I told her, okay, I've tried to do that, and they're denying us because they don't want to deal with workers' comp. So I took her referrals and I called them all for our area that we're in.
Yeah.
And they all told me that he was out of the scope of their expertise for his injuries. So I went back to her, and they're at a point where his claim hasn't been accepted or denied. And so we're in limbo with any kind of medical doctors to help him with the injuries on his face, which really need to be taken care of now and
because
not later, because
he's
going on 2 weeks.
Yeah, and Cassandra, you're right. We're like 12, 13 days into this. He's got broken suborbital bones and all the rest of this stuff in his face and his jaw.
Yes, and they're settling.
Oh, so in other words, they're going to try and, well, your body's going to try and knit.
Oh. Yeah, the body's settling. That's what I meant.
Yeah, the body is trying to knit things together already, and you're like, no, don't knit them together. We need to fix it first and then do the knitting stuff, right?
That's right.
So, and you're just, you're in a spot where you can't get anybody to work on you because the kind of insurance that workers' comp, you know, safe is required to be carried by all employers, but now you're finding out the doctors don't want to work for safe.
That's right. Big
wow.
time.
All right. So you need to have some money, obviously, just to, you know, to hold things together, even though because you've got workers' comp, I guess, should be paying part of your husband's regular paycheck while he's off work, right?
We would hope so.
And
the company has been really good about, you know, following through with us and getting me this information to, you know, get everything rolling. It's just we're at a standstill until they decide what they're going to do. And by that time, then you've got issues going on that could have been prevented.
By the way, your husband's tools were all in that truck, right? I mean, even though he's working for Triad, he had a lot of tools in that truck, right?
Yes, he did.
And people forget that when you work on big machinery, I've got my father-in-law's brother, Dwight, is a, you know, he's a mechanic on diesel engines, and he calls his toolbox his condo because back in the day when he had to buy one, it cost as much as a condo to buy a big toolbox. And Jay Stout Auctions is going to donate $1,000. Triad's a good customer of ours, so they're going to donate $1,000 to your GoFundMe, except it's not on GoFundMe, Cassandra. Where can people find the website?
It's Sassy Family through GoFundMe.
Oh, it is through GoFundMe.
Yeah,
okay, good.
I did. I think I sent you the link on there.
Well, we'll make sure people get it. If they miss it here on the radio, sometimes, you know, if they're longer, I'll just send them to people. I'll be glad to send it out to anybody who calls because it sounds like, see, Cassandra, you've got a family. It looks like you've got a big, beautiful family. The pictures are there on the GoFundMe page. You do right by your family. You've got a child who's had to go through 5 surgeries because mostly brain surgeries, right, for one of your children who's special needs.
Right. She has hydrocephalus.
But it looks like the rest of your family is just, I mean, a good, solid family. Dad works hard. You work hard. Everybody's doing the right thing. Everybody's carrying the right insurance. Everybody's minding their P's and Q's. And now the system is saying, I'm sorry, you have workers' comp, but you can't actually get anything out of it right now. And that kind of ticks me off.
I know. It's frustrating. And you can, there's not anything I can do.
Well,
at this moment.
At this point, we can at least make noise about it. And I'll be glad if you go to GoFundMe, it's for the Sassy family, S-A-S-S-E. And if you missed it, I'll send you the link because Cassandra sent me the link. And our best to you and to Lyle and to the whole family. And you take care.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Think about this. And I didn't go here, but I'm glad that Michael Early, who writes in by email, says, Lars, the Sassy family situation, this family where they're carrying all the insurance, you know, dad's got workers' comp, he's got a good company, Triad Machinery behind him, should be a lesson to all of us who are in favor of a single-payer system. Because guess what happens if you're in a single-payer system? And the single payer is the state. And like I said, if you think about it, most of the work by, say, an orthopedic surgeon or any of the doctors who might work on Mr. Sassy, Lyle Sassy, are people who do insurance work. I mean, how could you be an orthopedic surgeon and not do insurance work? Because you may have a few things where people come in and say, I need a bone spur removed or I need this or that. But an awful lot of your bread and butter has got to be people who are in car wrecks, people who fall off a ladder, you know, those kinds of things. If those are from private insurance companies and you say, oh, yeah, I'll work with them all day long, but I'm not working with the state workers' comp system. What does that say about the state workers' comp system when doctors say it is not worth the trouble to try to work through that system? That's not a good thing. And by the way, I do have a dog in the fight there. I have to write them a check every year for my employees. I'm not covered by the policy, but my employees are covered by the policy. And it's a few hundred dollars, $700 or $800 a year. But when I see the four-color brochure and the big fancy magazine they send out and all that stuff, I just wish, send me fewer of the brochures and just make sure that people get worked on. And the idea that you would have that insurance and find out it's worthless because it's coming from a government agency, it's pretty disturbing. Let's go to Audrey in Beaverton. Hey, Audrey, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
Well, I was prompted to call from a caller that called into you were talking to about 30 minutes ago.
Yeah.
About property tax. And that has been a real point of contention for me for quite some time. And I don't think that we fully addressed the concern.
I don't know for a fact, but I think that Oregon may be the only state, if not one of the only states, that actually increases property taxes by a percentage, ours being 3, every single year on top of everything that's bonded in, everything that's measured in. And I think it's kind of ridiculous because what's happened is, and what I think that the gentleman meant, is that when you take somebody out of their home, perfect scenario is you have a couple that they're retired.
Yeah.
So their income does no longer increases, okay?
As much.
But their property taxes, yeah. That's right. And so we've become, in at least in Oregon, I'll just speak, it's not a place where you can have basically a heritage home that you hand down to your kids and they hand down to their kids and the grandkids.
Okay, but hold up a second. First of all, if you're living in the home, whether your expenses are changing or not, you're still getting the services that are paid for with those property taxes. Among them, you may say, well, I don't get school services anymore because I don't have kids in school, but you have grandkids mm-hmm. in school, and you benefit by having an educated population, but you do get service from the sheriff, service from the local police department. You get the roads that are around you,
and somebody
has to pay
that
for
that. We don't pay taxes.
Okay.
No, I'm not suggesting that they don't pay them. I'm
right.
suggesting that there should be a cap. You know, my parents are a perfect scenario. Their property taxes are over $12,000 a year, and their neighbors are 17. And it's beyond ridiculous.
Hold on, you know, Audrey. You know that the late Don McIntyre, who is a very good friend of mine, I spoke at his funeral or at his eulogy. He got a cap. And then, but voters said, we want the ability to vote something beyond the cap. The cap was 1.5% of value. So it's $15 a thousand. Well, guess where Portland is? Portland's probably close to double that. Why? Because the voters said, we want to vote additional taxes on ourselves. And like it or not, the people who vote on the taxes are oftentimes not the ones who pay the taxes. So if you say...
No, and that's the problem. So, and this is where I was going with it. And when I say a cap, what I meant was that you pay whatever you were paying, let's say at age 65, that's what it stays.
Well, you can get the deferral, though. And when you're
okay,
look,
but a deferral just puts the burden on the on
I
your
know,
heir.
But I got to tell you, Audrey.
But they also put a percentage, a finance on that, too.
It's a tiny amount. But, Audrey, if somebody came to me, if I found out I had an uncle somewhere, my mom and dad are long since gone, and so are my grandparents. But if I had an uncle somewhere who left me a $300,000 house and I had to pay off, say, $20,000 in property taxes, I'd be thrilled. A $300,000 house, and
well,
all you have to pay is
a $300,000 house. But you know, when you live in Southwest Portland, I just would beg for you to try to find a house that is $300,000.
Well, I understand that, but you're talking about the ability to hand a house down to your kids. If your kids inherit a $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 house and have to pay $50,000 or $60,000 in taxes, they ought to get down on their knees and thank God that they had parents that were that generous. Because most parents would not.
No, absolutely. I understand exactly what you're saying, but I don't think you're not hearing what my point is that they're not making it possible for all. Maybe your parents were extremely successful and they have $1 million home, but you'll never qualify just for. I'm just presenting the issue, but you can't afford property taxes that are more than a mortgage.
I mean, when
you're looking at property taxes that are $1,500 a month.
Yeah, put most people in the poorhouse. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're all right.
Exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. All of this could have been avoided if we followed my plan.
Broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
What was it you were saying about my voice?
It's loud, it's strong, and it's good, and I appreciate your support.
This is Honestly Provocative Talk with Lars Larson.
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.
Now, here's Lars Larson.
Be sure and keep that volume up.
On FM News 101.
It's going to be one of the highest rated shows ever.
KXL.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your calls on this Monday at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. I'll tell you that I live in the part of America that has light rail to beat the band. I mean, they've got light rail in Seattle. They got light rail in Portland. But there are people, cities elsewhere in America, who are proposing light rail projects. And light rail, a lot like the Ferrari sports car, costs a hideous amount of money, carries very few people, but is really pretty to look at. And other than that, it's really not worth the money at all in my measure. It costs way too much money. And I saw a very interesting take on this whole problem from Randall O'Toole, who's been a regular guest on the program, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and the author of a brand new policy report called The Coming Transit Apocalypse. And Randall O'Toole joins me now. Randall, I think this is a fantastic conclusion you've drawn, that while all these cities are asking for billions and billions of dollars from our largely broke federal government, they're not even likely to get these projects done until light rail becomes, I guess, even less significant than it is today, because we're going to have driverless cars by then. Would you mind explaining that?
Well, that's absolutely right. You know, light rail was obsolete in 1930 when buses were cheaper, they were faster, they were more flexible, they could carry more people in an equivalent amount of land. In one lane, the buses could carry more people than streetcars or light rail. Driverless cars are going to be dominating our roads in another decade. We've got Ford Motor Company promising to have cars, mass-produced cars with no steering wheel, no brake pedal, no accelerator pedal by the year 2021, and flooding our cities with them. Uber and Google and Tesla are all racing to beat Ford. So we've got all these companies spending billions of dollars. It's clear that we're going to have driverless ride sharing that's going to cost less than transit costs today to go from where you are to where you want to go without you having to walk in the summer heat or the winter snows, and it'll be there. It'll be faster.
But for some reason, the folks...
Why would anybody be taking light rail in 10 years when Nashville and San Antonio and other cities will be opening their first light rail lines?
Well, it's funny because you mentioned that Ron Nirenberg, who is the mayor of San Antonio, that San Antonio almost, well, about 90 years ago, became the first major city to get rid of its streetcars with buses because they were faster and cheaper and more flexible. And now Nirenberg, the mayor of San Antonio today, plans to go out and put light rail down, even though his voters locally said no. They said no absolutely in 2000 and in 2015, but he still seems intent on spending billions of dollars on a system that may be obsolete by the time it's finished. Why?
That's right. And we see the same thing happening in Tampa and in Nashville. And, of course, Portland wants to expand their light rail system. Seattle recently convinced voters to spend $50 billion expanding their light rail system. Los Angeles recently convinced voters to support a light rail line that's going to cost almost $1 billion per mile. And it's not going to carry any more people than the funny little light rail cars you see in St. Louis or anywhere else.
Well, in Seattle,
you said they're pretty, but I think they're kind of ugly.
Well,
they're
actually
very dangerous. They kill three.
The only reason I say that, Randall, is that I have never seen a politician hold a news conference standing in front of a bunch of buses, but I have seen politicians hold news conference standing at light rail stations and in front of light rail trains. And look at Seattle. I mean, if you look at the whole package, they're talking about 60 miles and $54 billion. So if you do the math, they're just below $1 billion a mile to build that thing out, aren't they?
That's right. And the difference between light rail and buses is that light rail is expensive. And for politicians, the cost is the benefit. The more that it costs, the more money they have to hand out to contractors, to unions, to other special interest groups, and the more votes that they get, the more campaign contributions they get in return. So the benefit is the cost, and of course, to the taxpayer, it means they end up spending a lot more money and actually getting less service. So many cities have ended up cutting their bus service in order to pay for their expensive light rail lines. Portland and San Jose and Washington, D.C., and so on.
So what about the people who I know are listening to this right now, and they're probably going to call me in the next few minutes, skeptical of the idea that driverless cars are going to be a sensible replacement for a city bus system or a city transit system? Is there reason to think otherwise, that they are a good substitute?
Well, what we're seeing already is that Uber and Lyft and other ride-sharing services are taking rides away from transit. It used to, when they started out, they were considered to be a threat to taxis. But now they're taking rides away from transit. One-third of the people riding Uber and Lyft say that they would have taken transit if it weren't for Uber and Lyft. And you add up the rate of growth and compare it to the decline in transit ridership, and it's declining almost everywhere in the country. And it turns out the rate of growth in Uber and Lyft is explaining more than half the decline in transit ridership. So we're seeing Uber and Lyft take away rides, and when you take the driver out of the Uber and Lyft and other ride-sharing vehicles, the cost is going to come way down. It's going to be cheaper than a bus ride, cheaper than a light rail ride, to pull out your smartphone and pull up an app and have a car come straight to your door, pick you up, and take you where you want to go.
Well, I mean, I guess if you think about it, Randall, I know you know this because you're a transit consultant, and so you do this for a living. But I always think of the person who might be a transit rider, who might take the bus. But if they don't do it on a regular basis, they don't know the system. They're afraid of getting on a bus and ending up somewhere they don't want to go. And they don't know how long it's going to take them. And so the predictability isn't there. For somebody who does it on a daily basis, they can say, well, I know I have to leave my house by X to be able to get to work by Y if I'm going to take transit. And then they calculate in whatever is the fudge factor for the fact that transit sometimes breaks down or goes sideways or doesn't work. And light rail seems to have that problem a whole lot more than buses do. But if you had a system that was more like a driverless car system, like Uber or Lyft, except without even the cost of the human driver in it, and you could have both predictability so that somebody could say, I know if I leave my house in an Uber by this time, I can be at work or wherever I'm going by that time, I think you'd get a lot more users in a system like that than you do with the system that's sort of a one-size-fits-all generic, well, we'll get you there sometime around the time you thought you were going to get there, system that is city buses and trains.
Absolutely. And the hidden cost of rail transit is that about every 30 years, the systems need to be completely rebuilt. No transit agency ever prepares for that. And so we're seeing Portland system and Washington, D.C. system and New York and all over the country, we're seeing these things become less and less reliable, breakdowns, derailments, all kinds of problems. And so you can't trust the train to get you there on time any more than the bus. But when you call up an Uber or a Lyft or one of these other ride-sharing services, they'll tell you how many minutes it's going to take for the vehicle to get you to pick you up, how many minutes it's going to take to get you where you want to go. You've got a pretty good idea right there. They keep track of traffic conditions. They've got a pretty good idea right there how long it's going to take you to get where you want to go.
Absolutely right. Randall, where can people find this new report, The Coming Transit Apocalypse?
Well, you go to Cato's website, cato.org, C-A-T-O.org, and look for my name, Randall O'Toole, under the experts list, or go to the policy papers and look for it under there.
Randall, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for the time today.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you on. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our Twitter poll today, found online at the website LarsLarson.com and on Twitter at Lars Larson Show. Have the big cities of the Northwest become simply too dangerous to tolerate? Columbia Sportswear and its CEO, Tim Boyle, has indicated that he is likely going to move 45 employees out of downtown Portland. They were only moved in about a year ago. And they were moved in to great fanfare. They had a press conference, and Mayor Ted Wheeler was there, and it was all a big shindig. And then they found out what being in a downtown area is like in America today, where the police have been hamstrung in being able to deal with these things. Told by their political masters, basically, not to interact with these folks. The end result is you've got people assaulting your employees. You've got people using the outside of your entrance to your corporate headquarters as a toilet. And Tim Boyle says they've just about had enough of it. And they're ready to move all those employees out to someplace safer. And the question is, how will public officials respond to it? Well, I've got a message into Tim Boyle. He declined our offer to come on. I've got a message into the mayor of Portland. He has so far not responded. I'd like to talk to the new mayor, the brand new mayor of Seattle, but we'll try and arrange that down the line. I'd love to ask her a couple of questions about how she is going to deal with this kind of problem before you scare away all the best people and companies that might have come to your downtown area. Let's go to Greg, who's a naysayer. Hey, Greg, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, thanks for taking my phone call.
Always glad.
What's on my mind today? I just got a quick question for you.
All right.
So you seem pretty reluctant to believe any of the accusations against Roy Moore, but I know you believe.
Not at all. You're reading something in that you're. Look, what I've said is there's no way to prove them one way or the other. And that is the truth, and I think you'd admit that's true.
But I also heard you say on Thursday, because of how long it took for the accusers to come out.
I wasn't as concerned at the time. I wasn't as concerned about the time as I am about the timing of the accusations and the election that's about to happen. And I'm also concerned about this. Do you mind if I ask you a couple of questions to illustrate the point?
Sure.
Okay. If it's true that a 32-year-old Roy Moore was sexually attracted to teenage girls, what does that say that Roy Moore is in the simplest terms possible?
A pedophile?
Right. Now, he's a pedophile. Every pedophile I've ever done a story on over the last 40 years has usually started small with small actions, usually very young in life, sometimes in their teenage years, sometimes in their 20s. And then they get worse over the decades. I don't know of a single one where you had somebody who was engaging in pedophile-like behavior where it just suddenly got better. You know, like when you skin your knee and 2 weeks later it gets better. When you're a pedophile, it doesn't get better. It usually gets worse. At best, it might stay at the same level. What happened then between the 70s? If we assume, based on the evidence that's presented 30 days out from an election, and I am suspicious of that, what does it say we should have expected from a 32-year-old Roy Moore who was attracted to teenage girls and was perhaps even assaulting them already? The one young lady, you know, who he talked into going into the woods and taking most of her clothes off and that sort of thing. The woman who's come out today who says that he got her in his car and wouldn't let her go. And she was a teenager as well. Did he just stop being a pedophile?
And correct me if I'm wrong. That woman said that her and her husband voted for Donald Trump. So what they're saying now isn't actually motivated.
Well, it may or may not be. I mean, some of the other ones apparently do have some political ties, but I haven't gone to that. You know, I mean, it came up late last week that at least one of them has a sign language company that's done some work for liberal politicians. And so you might think they might have a dog in the fight there. But let's leave all that aside. That may or may not bear on this. At this point, I'll leave this.
I think that's all. We got five women now that don't know each other personally that all have very similar stories. It only takes one of the accusers.
I know. And you know what? Do you know what I find? And I will tell you, one of the things I did spend a lot of time on last week, not what you said, which was the amount of time that's gone by, but what made me curious is the Wall Street Journal story about this is they went to Alabama to cover the primary that made Roy Moore the nominee. And while they were there, they heard this rumor that apparently has been around for 40 years, even though the last identified people involved in, you know, maybe being the victims of a pedophiliac Roy Moore 40 years ago, apparently rumors gone nowhere with local press. It's gone nowhere with anyone else. But somehow Washington Post hears the rumor. And within a couple of weeks, they magically find four or five women who all have remarkably consistent stories that all, you know, fall into their lap as a reporter. And I can tell you how hard it is to find people, because I've been on hunts like that myself as a reporter, saying, I think this politician or I think this person is involved in something bad. I want to find some of his victims. It is exceedingly hard to do that. The Washington Post amazingly quickly found this info, which makes me a little suspicious of it.
Yeah, I understand your suspicion, but I don't see anything good for any of the people that are accusing Roy Moore. I know some of them have already got death threats. Like, I don't really see what benefit for any of these women coming out.
Well, let me ask you another question in aid of an objection, as the lawyers like to say. Greg, have you ever seen people come out and make really outrageous claims to get attention, and where their only gain was not financial, it wasn't political, it was just attention? Ever seen that happen?
Yeah, and I'm sure it happens with people that have public notoriety. I'm sure that does happen.
And let me ask you, what is
for women now, for someone, I
get it, you've said that, but now, for these women, what is the cost of making this claim? And as you've said, some of them may get some negative attention, but likely short-lived. If the stories are not true, is there any consequence for the people who tell the stories? Any negative consequence?
In most circumstances, that's going to take a wild guess. Probably not.
Yeah. Do you remember a year ago? I get it.
Be on NBC or
I get it. Do you remember a year ago when there were a whole bunch of women accusing Donald Trump of doing a whole bunch of different things before the election?
Oh yeah, and I still actually personally think that most of those women are probably telling the truth.
Why did they drop most of the claims after the election? You'd think they would want even more to pursue the claim. Well, but that doesn't protect you from claims of bad behavior. Oh, you've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I love talking to Greg the Naysayer. He calls in about once a week, and it's funny because Tom Berger writes in about this. Roy Moore, but what about Menendez? Yeah, Menendez, where they have a hung jury at this point. The jury has told the judge they haven't been able to make a decision yet. And do you know, one of the juror questions as they consider the corruption charges against Senator Menendez from New Jersey, one of the jurors sent a question in, I kid you not, that said, can you please explain what a senator is? Now, I know the quality of juries has suffered a lot over the years, but apparently it's worse than some of us thought. As Tom writes in, cue crickets on Menendez. It has been going on 65 days, and the networks don't seem to know about it. If it's not Fox, you wouldn't even know. Roy Moore, on the other hand, if he so much as burps, it makes the headlines. I can name two elections that Obama won using sex crimes innuendo, state Senate seat and first U.S. Senate race, and he's right about that. Herman Cain was taken down with sexual pest claims or an affair. Anita Hill tried it with Clarence Thomas, the one that didn't work, and it was a late one, too. And they tried it on Trump as well. The number one reason I think that the whole Roy Moore thing is a joke is that they marched out that joke Gloria Allred. Every single party that I've seen or heard is a liberal. Washington Post, Gloria Allred, one of the accusers, worked for Hillary Clinton. Bannon is right. This is a classic Democrat hit job, just like the dossier, just like the other sex scandals that they initiated. And, Tom, I think you're absolutely right about that. The timing of it alone ought to make you very, very suspicious. It makes me concerned, I guess, angry, that people could make these kinds of charges and they know that if they're successful, Roy Moore will be knocked out of the race. And if they're not successful, nobody will ever know whether the charge itself was true or not. Let's go to Art in Ferndale, listening on KGMI. Hey, Art, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. How are you?
Mispronounced my name, Lars. This is Bart.
Oh, Bart. Well, you know what? We're going to teach somebody about phonetic spelling, but go ahead.
After Art. And I was actually not even calling. I called because of the conversation you were having with the gentleman on the transit system in Seattle and stuff, which I don't know much about, so I don't comment too much on that. But on the autonomous vehicles, you know?
Yeah.
I'm just going to pitch this out there, and then you can go with it where you want, but you know, at first I was like, oh, wow, that's kind of cool. Although I'm a car guy. I like cars. I like driving and, you know, and of course I drive truck for a living. And then I started thinking, wait a minute. Now, if all these automobiles are going to be running autonomously, they're obviously going to be linked some way to the internet, right? Because the GPS system has to work.
Well, I doubt it. I doubt it, and I'll tell you why, Bart. I'll tell you why it wouldn't be. Because if you link, if you say there has to be a link to the internet, then the minute that link is broken, if the link is essential to the self-guidance of the car, then any kind of break in the internet is going to cause a problem. I think what what you're more likely to see is autonomous driving cars, which have maps in them that are independent of the internet. I mean, in other words, if I've driven out to places where there is no cell, there is no internet, there is no nothing, and I can turn on my car and the GPS will tell me where I'm located on the map, so it's autonomous of the internet.
So perhaps what I was saying about internet, that's a bad analogy, but like you said, and what got me thinking is like you take a company like Swift, they got, I don't know, about 18,000 trucks on the road. Now these trucks are all tied into dispatch. And these are going to be electronically dispatched if they are autonomous. And I guess, I don't know, I mean, maybe it's my own ignorance, but what is going to keep these things from being hacked? What is going to keep a hacker from figuring out how to get into that system? And, you know, I mean, I guess I'm just thinking the worst of the worst because that's the world we live in. But you think one guy jumping the curb and running through a crowd of people is bad. What are you going to do when you got 1,000 semi-trucks do it at the same time?
Well,
you follow me? I mean,
I assume that you're probably right that it may be able to be hacked, but I also assume that there will be safeguards built into a lot of this and maybe even safeguards that go, if you will, too far. For example, if you're in your own personal vehicle, do you have a four-wheel drive? Okay, and so do I. So if you decide someday you're driving back from Ferndale and there's a blockage in the road, but you really have to get through, you could go off road, couldn't you?
Sure.
And you would probably be breaking the law and maybe even driving over somebody's private property. Do you want to bet that when they get autonomous vehicles, they're likely going to have prohibitions built into them that say you cannot drive this car off road?
Right. Yeah, okay, and that's exactly right, and that's what got me thinking. I forget what the movie was that I watched, and I know that sounds silly, but they literally trick this GPS system into thinking that its pathway was straight through the middle of some place, I don't know, I just got to thinking about all that, and I thought, and I mean, it sounds preposterous, but guess what? So does Experian losing 140 million people's personal information, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people out there a lot smarter than I am. And if this has occurred to me, you know, and you've got North Korea. North Korea has a hacking team. They would love nothing more than to figure out how to bring down the entire internet.
But let me ask you something, though. Bart, think about this, though. Of all the accidents that happen on the highways, how many of them are human error? Isn't it approaching 100? Well, almost. There are
almost every one of them.
I would say almost, and I would agree with you.
By the way,
what?
It's my experience that they're almost all from following too close.
I agree with you. Now, I would allow that there probably are a few accidents, and as we head into winter weather this winter, there are going to be accidents where even if somebody is driving flawlessly, there will be some flaw in the pavement or flaw in the ice that would get even an odd. But for the most part, it's human caused. So if you could eliminate all of the human caused accidents, and then you had occasionally an instance where somebody managed to get a hold of the system or the system had a flaw in the self-driving cars, which, by the way, the first time you have that accident, they will go back in and they will wall off that part of the self-driving software, won't they?
I would think so, yeah. I know they just had one on the road in Las Vegas.
Yeah, but do you know what caused that? Bart, you're a truck driver.
I don't know.
Do you know who? I love this. You're going to love this, too. The truck driver caused the accident, and here's how. The self-driving van had come to a stop. The driver of the truck in front, and this is from the reporting by the Las Vegas Review-Journal, the truck driver in front began backing up illegally. know, illegally in the sense that he was violating whatever city codes were there. He began backing up. Now, a human in that van likely would have been laying on the horn about that time, about the time the truck got 2 feet from the front of your vehicle. You'd have been laying on the horn. And instead, the truck, which was being driven by a human, backed up into the van, which was being driven by a software program, which did not lay on the horn because apparently they hadn't programmed that into it. And so that's why apparently the van suffered a little bit of damage, a relatively minor amount, because the human truck driver backed his truck into the van, and the van didn't know how to quickly do what it could have done, which is either lay on the horn or back up.
It's definitely going to be interesting, Lars, to see how this all turns out. And then, of course, we have to consider the factor of what are we going to do when millions of jobs are lost because of,
Bart,
the truckers alone. But
Bart, you're starting to sound like Barack Obama, who I think is a full-blown idiot. He was the guy who was saying, why, do you know all the jobs we've lost because of this new thing called ATMs? And ATMs had been around for about 25 years when Barack Hussein Obama made this comment, but he was acting as though it was something brand new. And I remember thinking,
ATMs created jobs. No, I read a whole article on this.
Yeah, well, and think about this. If you follow that logic, do you know how many jobs we eliminated when we started unloading cargo ships with cranes lifting 80-ton containers instead of having guys with hand trucks lifting it using their backs?
Absolutely. And I, Lars, I'm totally on board with you because I'm all for moving forward, and I get that. And I wanted to throw this out there as well. Well, now that you made that great point. You know, when they went, I was a caregiver for a while. I took care of some elderly folks. These folks were awesome.
Yeah.
In the late 90s. I mean, walking history books to just talk with them. But they were, I mean, back when they were farming, when they were kids, it was all hands on deck and everybody worked on the farms and that was it. And then they started, as the equipment came and the equipment, you know, and they began to farm and they did not need all hands on deck. But at some point, though, now back then most people didn't even have a high school diploma. And at some point, the people of America said, you know what? Okay, we're going to be needing smarter people to do smarter people's jobs. And they had a high school drive. And it was, you got to look it up. But it's,
I will take a look at it. Bart, thank you very much. And see, I don't really think you're a Democrat. You never were. You were a conservative the whole time. You're just a closet conservative. You're a double C. Back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday live on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let me go to Stephen first. Stephen, welcome to the program. What's on your mind, sir? Hello, Stephen. See, Stephen's not paying attention, so Stephen misses his chance. Let's go to James. Hey, James, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, hi, Lars. I've noticed a problem that may be related to your Twitter thing on downtown problems with the company moving out. But I see our drug problem as a great problem. They have opiates, all this. And I'm wondering what can, if anything, can be done about our big drug pusher and the drug Earl Blumenhauer.
Oh.
I mean, he is trying to create a pact to go against other Congress members who are against legalizing marijuana. And there's a lot of people who argue one way or the other, but it really is a gateway drug. I see it as that. People want, if they get something that makes them feel good or something, and they can debate on whether it happens to everybody or not, that's not the point. The point is, does it give you a feeling that you want more of? And for a lot of people, that's true. And that's why I say it's a gateway drug. And in my day, and the group Steppenwolf wrote a song about it, The Pusher Man, but in my day, the pusher was a bad thing. So to me, Earl Blumenhauer is a pusher now.
He's a pusher man.
Because of his wanting to try and make sure we can get marijuana to everybody.
And unfortunately, the people in Oregon and the Northwest seem to love those liberal members of Congress. Let's go to Stephen. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
What's on your mind, sir?
Well, I was just responding to Greg. What I find particularly interesting is that people, first of all, let me say that anybody that commits sexual assault of any type is heinous.
Agreed.
But also, it's always kind of funny, like you're saying, on these election times, you know, all these people come out, whether they be against Democrats or Republicans, and Gloria Alvarez there. And so I wouldn't worry about it because she's more or less just an ambulance chaser.
Well, see, the thing that bothers me most about this is that you're saying Republicans who are coming out trying to take away
Democrats.
But in this case, I expect the Democrats to oppose a conservative like Roy Moore. I do not expect the establishment rhinos like Mitch McConnell to be out trying to undercut their own party, except that I think McConnell...
Isn't he a lawyer?
What's that?
Isn't he a lawyer, McConnell?
Oh, I don't know if he is or not. If he is, he hasn't practiced in a long time.
Why would he be against due process then?
Well, except there is no... You know, there's the bottom line is... There will never be due process on these charges. You know that, right?
Because, I know, that's a sad thing.
Well, because most of them, even the most recent accuser who came out today, says this happened to her in 1977. That's 40 years ago. There will never be, there could be a civil case at some point.
Right.
But even with a civil case, what proof would you offer of something that you say happened between two people alone and by themselves at night 40 years ago, where there's no way to prove it did happen? On the other hand, there's no way to prove it didn't, and a jury might be very sympathetic.
I believe in the end, my point is it's all about character assassination.
Yep. Yeah, it is.
That's all it is.
And I guess if the new standard is going to be the minute an accusation has been made, we must believe that it's right and act accordingly. Let me see when's the first time.
That way.
No, when are the Democrats going to follow that rule? Because Bill Clinton.
I'm with you.
Bill Clinton was accused accurately for 6 months before he finally came out and admitted it. And the only reason he admitted it is because there was DNA evidence on the front of that blue dress. But for the DNA evidence.
And he lost his law license. Ooh.
Yeah, big deal. He doesn't care about that. He and Hillary made tons of money anyway. Well, that's the situation we're in right now. And to have Republicans actually saying, well, Roy Moore needs to resign. And Roy Moore, even if he's elected by the people of Alabama, you've actually got people in the Senate right now saying that they will refuse to seat him in the United States Senate. That is absolute lunacy. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.